Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is David Skinner, and David has written The Story of Ain't America, Its Language in the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. He says at the beginning of this book, when researching the story of Webster's third dictionary, although the book encompasses much more than that, he became more interested in what brought about this controversy, and it was a very big controversy in this country. Why did Americans in 1961 become so exercised, so irate, that several otherwise sane and distinguished persons said a mere dictionary, however imperfect, represented nothing less than the end of the world? He writes about Webster's third, also Webster's second, and Webster's first, and he writes about British pronunciation and American pronunciation and literary figures and like Henry James and Mark Twain and H.L. Mencken. The book is worth the price just to read because I have never come upon this before. H.L. Mencken's rewriting of the Declaration of Independence in a way that, you know, makes sense, I think. David is a writer. He's an editor. He lives in Virginia. He is the editor of Humanities Magazine, published by the National Endowment for the Humanities. And he is also on the usage panel for the American Heritage Dictionary. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about ain't and other words and how dictionaries are put together and how certain words make their way into the dictionary and didn't used to and do now and why that's the case and why there's such an uproar about it. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, David. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, and thanks for that very nice introduction.
You're welcome. It's interesting, when you write a book like this, you're taking on a whole lot. It's more than just the making of a dictionary, right?
Right. When I proposed to write this book about a dictionary controversy, several people said to me, but what was going on in the language during all these years? Was there a lot of change that leads up to the controversy? And
right.
I had to say, well, yeah, a little more than I can squeeze into a book, maybe. But I immediately agreed to try to do that because there was a lot going on between the Great Depression and World War II, and the GI Bill in the 1950s, and also the rise of linguistics. The academic study of language was burgeoning during these same years, developing a sort of rival view of the language as most people understood it. So there was a lot going on in America, and what was going on in America thoroughly colored the opinion of language, but also the use of language.
Right. Tell me, before we talk about all of that, just the process of putting together a dictionary. Who are the people? This is a colorful and interesting and sometimes snobbish and sometimes not cast of characters who are making decisions, and it's a long process to put one of these, to compile a dictionary.
Indeed, it is. It's really the work of generations. It's I mean, sometimes you, in the 19th century and the 18th century, you read about, you know, people, individuals who made dictionaries, but it's not really possible anymore unless you wrote a very short dictionary with a very narrow focus. The way a dictionary is made, a dictionary entry is made, is that you start with a word, and it could be a common word, it could be an exotic word, and what you have to do is you have to find evidence of it in the language. So you have to find some book or some television transcript or radio transcript that shows the word being used. It's funny, but there have been, in fact, dictionary definitions of words that were, you know, perhaps used once or even never. And so you show the word in action, and that quotation that you take from of the word is called a citation. And for each word, you have a file as you collect citations of that word in use. And a dictionary maker like Merriam-Webster has files that go back to Noah Webster in the early 19th century, even the late 18th century, being collected back then. And so what you end up with if you're working with one of these files is a pile of citations that goes back for centuries. And your job as the lexicographer, the person writing the definition, is to crystallize, synthesize all that information and divide it into senses. And then there's someone else's job to write a pronunciation or perhaps several pronunciations for that word.
Mm-hmm.
It may be another editor's job to write any usage notes or to say, whether the word is considered slang or, informal or this or that. It might be another person's job to write verbal illustrations, sort of generic, usages for the word, like the word hat. Every boy on the baseball team wore a hat on the field. I don't know, something really innocuous like that. So the making of a dictionary entry in a big dictionary like Merriam-Webster dictionary it involves a whole cast of people. And like a lot of very technical editorial work, it's painstaking work. One person does his part of the job, and then five or six other people review it. And
right.
Of course, everything gets proofread to root out error and to make all of these definitions alike, in that they all conform to certain policies of how the dictionary should be written. It's the most, it's very technical writing, and it's very painstaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say boring writing. I can never do it for a living myself because it's so incredibly tedious. But the result is a highly polished piece of work that is very useful to the dictionary consultant, the person looking up the word.
Let's contrast the opening celebrations for the second Webster's Dictionary and the third dictionary, because they say a whole lot about the personalities involved, the snobbishness in some cases that's involved in this, the debate that's involved about whether or not we use everyday speech in a dictionary and if we can bring the dictionary to a common level, or if it's supposed to educate us and let us know what is proper, how we should use the language. I found your descriptions of both of those events highly interesting.
Thanks. Well, in 1934, Webster's second came out, and it was kind of a genteel, polite dictionary. And they used the party for the dictionary to basically announce its arrival. And it was a kind of society event. It was at a hotel ballroom in Springfield. The men were well dressed. I think it seemed to have been a formal affair, showing men in tuxedos and several courses on the menu and a big oil portrait of Noah Webster hanging up in the front of the room.
Oh my!
And it's almost the whole room. It's a very big room and hundreds of people, and they're almost all men. And the invitation list has been carefully curated to bring together representatives of the world of education and the world of publishing and the universities and journalism, and it's kind of like a meeting of the minds of the upper crust of intellectual America. And what they're really trying to do with this party in 1934 is suggest and publicize a kind of polite consensus among educated Americans about the superiority of a Webster's dictionary over every other kind of dictionary, but also a kind of consensus, a unity of point of view about what good English is.
Mm-hmm.
To us today, it seems incredibly pompous and incredibly old-fashioned, but that's what it was like. when Webster's third came out in 1961, it was very different. The sort of middle managers of Merriam-Webster were now running things, and they had no time for patience for a big formal party that was, basically to be photographed in the New York Times. They wanted an actual party for the people who did all the work, the underlings,
right.
the pronunciation editor, the etymologist. I mean, they wanted all those people. It was really a party for them. It was like a cast party for, a small theatrical production, and it was at the director's house, but not the director's house. In this case, it was the editor-in-chief's house, Philip Gove's house, which is a farm in Massachusetts, and I mean, it was him and his friends and his colleagues, and they served dinner on the porch, and Gove was standing on the back of a hay wagon pouring drinks for his editors, and people were getting drunk. there were puppet shows in the living room making fun of the dictionary. I mean, in 1934, they would not have cracked a joke about their own dictionary. They would not have made fun of themselves. It just would never have crossed their mind that the way to celebrate their work was to mock themselves. But in 1961, that's kind of where they were. They had produced a very serious dictionary, and in some ways a more serious dictionary than their predecessors had. But they were not of this. They were not public facing people. They did not think it was their job, you know, when they woke up in the morning to present to America and the world the view of America's learned classes. They took a scientific view of the language. And so where there is variety in the language, whether it's in accent or in usage or in education, levels of education, they did not want to present what they thought was the right way to use the language. They wanted to report on the language honestly as it was used. They wanted to describe it, not prescribe it. So they did not, when they were bringing out their dictionary, they did not think that they were announcing for America the learned view of the language, the correct view of the language. They were just trying to describe it as it was.
And you weave in, which I find fascinating, authors. We've got the Henry James view. We've got the Mark Twain view. We've got, God bless him, H.L. Mencken. I just loved reading some of what he rewrote. But it was something that was percolating all in literary circles among people who were famous writers, the correct way to do things, right? The correct way to write, to write language. It was everywhere in society. It was discussed.
Definitely. I mean, into the teens of the 20th century, sort of British example is still sort of reigning supreme. One editor of that time complains that a sort of mediocre British novelist can come and tour the United States and be received as a sort of revered guest, whereas a pretty good American novelist struggles to sell a few copies. There was a kind of there wasn't yet a real respect for either the American use of English or American literature. In the 1920s, however, things start to change very quickly. H.L. Mencken brings out a very thoughtful, well-researched volume called The American Language. He doesn't even call it English. He calls it American. And what he's trying to do is document and show respect for the way Americans use English. And at the same time, American literature is really coming of age in the 1920s. It's the age of Hemingway and Fitzgerald, and things are changing fast. We're producing some world-class literary artists. And things speed up even in the 1930s as, you know, Faulkner and Zora Neale Hurston and John Steinbeck also weigh in and start, you know, mining sort of dialectical American English, you know, the way less educated Americans speak in out of the way places, you know, far from Cambridge, Massachusetts or Springfield, Massachusetts or New York City, how field hands use English, how country preachers use English, you see that showing up in the most serious literature that America is producing in those days. So there's a lot going on. How American literary writers think of the language is changing in a very fundamental way.
Mm-hmm.
The newspapers and the news magazines are also bringing a lot to the table. The rise of Time magazine, which begins in the 20s and becomes huge very, very quickly. It's a very slangy magazine, very unlike the Time magazine today. And Variety becomes quite famous, and Walter Winchell is quite famous. And there's a kind of public embrace of the jocular side of the language, of the slangy side of American English in these years, and it creeps into very respectable circles. Even as the folks who make Webster's Second are pretending that that there's a real bright line between good English and bad English, That's not what's going on in the public, in the culture at large. Things are the ground is moving beneath them, and they don't quite realize it in Springfield.
You know, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about the fact that this British example is still prevalent, I think, in American media. You look at the number of analysts who are Brits, you know, they're not Americans, and it seems to add some kind of credence. We have good English. We have people who speak good English, or the success of, I'm going to run into trouble here because I know a lot of people love this show, but this huge success of Downton Abbey and the way they all speak and the way they all live, we still find this fascinating, and I still think that many people are looking to the British example of this is the way it's done.
I think that's true, and I say that as a, you know, an Anglophile. I read, you know, George Eliot and Charles Dickens and Woodhouse and Evelyn Waugh.
Sure.
I love these writers,
right.
And I feel like they're a part of my heritage too. And it's strange. I mean, the success of Downton Abbey, it really is remarkable. But it's a good show. But there is something I think almost non-linguistic about this, which is that the British are. There's a sort of intellectual confidence and a kind of cultural swagger to them that it seems remarkable even to non-English speaking cultures. I think in France it's just sort of assumed that if you're British you're a very very witty person. But I think here in the United States you're definitely onto something. We are still Anglophile, and we are still almost a little bit too reverential about British example. I was in a conversation with some people, some very sophisticated people once, and we were talking to a woman who had spoke several languages and learned English in London, and someone said, "Well, you and then you mastered English and you learned it where they really speak it right." I was ready to walk away. I was ready to just abandon that conversation at that very moment. Are you kidding me? What do you think we're speaking? I mean, are we supposed to apologize every time we open our mouth that we're not speaking with a London accent, that we're not saying posh and toff and all? Are you kidding me? And I think that's really the attitude of H.L. Mencken, which is a real education to read him on this subject, because you realize how in the 19th century and the early 20th century there was a real we had a very humble attitude toward British English, which was it's cringe making to read about it now sometimes, to read about some of the 19th century grammarians and how they were practically apologizing for American usage to the British. And to read that, it's just so frustrating. You know, in the day of Mark Twain, that we should be apologizing for anyone for
I'm with you. You're right. You're absolutely right. Let's take phone calls. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we'll be with you momentarily. I'm going to ask at some point, whenever it weaves into the conversation, for our guest to read one of the classic parodies of vulgar American English, H.L. Mencken rewriting the Declaration of Independence. It's funny, but it makes sense what he has to say. You think about how those lovely words can be put into a different kind of English, and it's still, you get the message. You understand what he's saying. Our guest is David Skinner. He is the author of The Story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. We'll be with you in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, the author of The Story of Ain't, David Skinner. The book is subtitled America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. Let's go to phone calls, and we start with Fred in Palmyra. Hello, Fred.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I ain't no pedantic English user. But my parents were immigrants and came over in the 20s, and when my mother taught me English, she insisted that we speak proper English. She had aspirations toward being middle class or maybe even better. And She didn't want anybody to think we were vulgar, so I was schooled and always read a lot. And people I meet casually at a subway station or anything just strike up a conversation with someone, assume that I'm college-educated. And so my vocabulary and my language apparently is just, you know, at least creates that impression. But what I wonder about is that professional writers, and I see this in journalism and in other media, where they use terms like got married or got divorced, when correctly, to marry someone, or they were married, is a verb, right? And so is divorced. And where do we get things like what do we got instead of what do we have? And on captions on television, I see that they even run words together like going to, or what are we going to do, and what are, and they print it as what are we gonna do. And so I'll let you hash that over and listen.
Thank you, Fred.
Well, let's see. Get and got. Those are in a lot of ways sort of problematic words in our language. They get used a great deal in a lot of uneducated speech. But of course they appear and are current in educated speech as well. I think a lot of people, I think, you know, school teachers especially run into this, where kids seem to have at their disposal no other verbs but, you know, got. I have an English teacher friend who sent me a parody of a kid using get and got for absolutely every word, every verb he needed in a long speech. There's nothing, to my mind, particularly wrong about got married. It's colloquial English. It's colloquial American English, certainly. I'm not sure what your complaint there is, I don't have a beef with your mother, by the way. I think we all aspire to speak well and to write well. It's part of sort of making the most of who we are. I think some linguists get annoyed when they hear about people striving to be more middle class and more bourgeois in their speech and their writing, but it seems to me it's a very natural instinct or impulse, just as it is to try to improve yourself in any area of your life, whether it's, you know, athletically or, you know, in the way you dress. We all have times when we strive to be better than who we are, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's interesting to hear about the perspective of immigrants on English, because they naturally take a different view. One reason is it's too much to learn for an immigrant or for a new speaker how, you know, all the varieties in which, you know, of the language. They really, you know, when they have a question for of how to say something, they really need one or two good answers, not all the available answers that a dictionary like Webster's Third gives you.
Hmm. And there is a great deal to be said for this, having a large vocabulary. Don't you think that's a good thing?
I do think that's a real nice advantage as a reader and as a speaker, and it's something it's something that really only comes from a lot of reading. I don't think it actually comes so effectively from those build your vocabulary with 15 minutes a day.
You don't think
type,
so?
Type courses.
My mom used to do, and this was way before somebody made a buck on it. But she, every day we would have a new word a day she would teach us, and I just thought that was so endearing. Mom, you could have made money off that. You just needed calendars.
I mean, they're fun. It's certainly fun with the calendars. You know, sometimes they'll have really funny, exotic words.
I know.
You would never run into
right
if you didn't have this calendar of goofy
right
words.
But then you would try to figure out some way to use them during the course of the day, and that would be a challenge and a lot of fun. Brian in Oregon. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Yes, I was born in 1961, and my grandfather actually was Philip Gove. So I don't actually remember the party that you were describing in your book, but which I did read, by the way, and I can actually envision my grandfather in overalls on the hay wagon. I have some fond memories of that farm. But anyway,
that was your grandfather? Well, I'm sorry, that was your grandfather?
Philip Goad was my grandfather.
Oh.
And anyway, I did read the book, and I have a basic question. I wasn't quite sure how you felt about the prescriptive-descriptive debate.
Brian, your name is?
Yes.
Who's your parent?
My mom is Susan.
Okay.
Not Doris, who also you had an excellent chapter on Doris and a school bus incident.
Yeah, I've also spoken to Norwood, but I'm sorry. Let me answer your question. In the book, I didn't want to make my opinion of the descriptivist versus prescriptivist dispute the kind of centerpiece of the book. I wanted people to be able to kind of form their own opinions about it. It's not that I don't have an opinion. I do have kind of, I guess, a sort of complicated opinion that grows out of a few different facts. One is that I'm a professional editor. So every day I go into an office and I act as a prescriptivist. I correct other people's usage all the time. I correct, I change the way they write to conform to my own idiosyncratic notions of what will make a sentence or a paragraph or an article or an mm-hmm. essay work better. That said, I've learned a great deal from reading the descriptivists, reading the academic scholars of language, and I learned a lot from reading your grandfather's own words about varying levels of usage throughout America and how that affects the dictionary maker's job to honestly represent not only how educated people speak, but how uneducated people speak, and not only how East Coast or New England people speak, but how people in Oregon or Wisconsin or California right. or Texas speak. So I feel like all of us are prescriptivists in a way, in that we all have notions of good English that we follow, at least in our own speech and writing. But anyone who's really interested in language, they can't just ignore what the descriptivists have done. The sort of descriptive practice behind dictionary making has, I mean, that's the dictionaries have always been, basically descriptivist, at least in their methods. And collecting evidence of how a word is used. And if you look at the Oxford English Dictionary, you get a historic description of words over time. As a writer, as a person who likes language, I find that information invaluable. Hmm. Why wouldn't I want to know that?
Sure.
I may not want some dictionary editor to make up, to decide for me how to use shall and will, but I'm really glad when they tell me the history of shall and will.
And Brian, tell me, I know you were born in 61 when mm-hmm. this was published, but I'm interested in the relationship you had with your grandfather and the family discussion concerning, the subsequent discussion concerning the publication of Webster's Third.
Well, that is pretty interesting. He died when I was about 10, maybe 11 years old, so didn't really know him very well, from a non-childhood sort of way. And he was not, I guess, a really cuddly sort of guy. He was kind of the grandfather that kind of kids should be seen and not heard. You're kind of pretty careful around him. I remember once messing up his fishing rod, and I got a lot of grief for that. But. As far as the family and how we talk about this quite a lot, I mean, I did not really was aware of the controversy back at that time when I was growing up, but of course I've become aware of it, as the years have gone on, and kind of almost find it a little bit of amusing, first of all, very proud, of what he had done, and apparently it was quite a big undertaking and a lot of effort, but kind of amusing that it was so, I guess, controversial, I think me and the family pretty much always side with him and the, kind of descriptive sort of mentality there.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you were listening.
I did have one more question.
Sure.
Just, Does Mr. Skinner think there's going to ever be a need for a fourth edition, or is it pretty much kind of been settled and we can just keep updating the third forever?
Brian, thank you so much for calling, and thanks for asking that question. Both questions. Let's see. Webster's fourth is already happening. There's a team of editors at Merriam-Webster already working on Webster's fourth. I don't know how many of them there are, and I don't know how large a project it's currently envisioned to be. But I gather from talking to them recently that it's going to be A, online, and B, cumulative, meaning they're going to start putting stuff up as they make it. they won't simply be working toward, you know, a publication date. They're going to publish online as they go and sort of postpone the decision about whether there is a call for a printed dictionary. So Webster's fourth is happening quite soon, but it's not going to be it's going to be a cumulative thing, and it's not going to be, you know, another 450,000 or 500,000 word behemoth like the one your grandfather made.
So you can't use it for a doorstop, or you can't display it prominently in your living room. It's going to be online. What a sign of change that is.
Yeah, I mean, how will people know you're really educated if you don't have these humongous books in your living room?
I know, exactly. Thank you, Brian, so much for your call. You're a very interesting caller. I'm glad you were listening. We go to Rich in Oshkosh next. Hi, Rich.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We just had a question about 300 years of history, the English language here in Canada and Wisconsin, and the speech impediment that has taken place over the last 300 years. The historian who was on public radio some years ago talked about the king and queen had speech impediments for the last 300 years, and they were captivated by the British people to talk the way we hear them today. So this accent that we hear today is kind of copied, or what you might say mimicked, from the king and queens over the last 300 years. And maybe when they say drawer, instead of draw, we say draw, they say drawer. And you'll hear this on the East Coast also. Could we hear more about, if he knows, who the historians would know more about this?
I wish I did, but I know you're talking about the difference between rhotic and a non-rhotic pronunciation. There are a lot of final R's in British pronunciation that you don't find in American pronunciation. And of course the royal example is very important in how sort of people try to speak. But as for whether that's the result of some individual's speech impediment, I don't know anything about that, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's interesting. Let us know more when you find out more. We need to spend, I can't believe we haven't done this yet, but there are certain figures you highlight in the book we need to talk about. One who's discussed quite a bit is Dwight MacDonald. How does he figure into all of this story?
Well, the controversy over Webster's third is in many ways a journalistic controversy. It starts with newspapers pouncing on the dictionary for its mistreatment of, or for its treatment of the word ain't. It leads up to a kind of literary controversy where several essayists, Dwight MacDonald chief among them, go to town on the dictionary for many, many possible sins. And Dwight MacDonald is very interesting to me as an example of a kind of highly opinionated fists and elbows type intellectual writer. And in the 20th century, there's in America increasing employment for such people. And he worked at the New Yorker, but he also worked at Partisan Review, and he started his own journal called Politics. And he's an exceptional writer. He's still respected and fawned over by a lot of journalists and intellectuals today. But he also has a very colorful political career in terms of his ideological leanings. He never ran for office, but he started out working at Fortune magazine, which was really a capitalist tool, as they call it. But then he turned sort of socialist and revolutionary in his mindset, and was part of the crowd of people in the 30s who basically kind of assumed that the end of capitalism was near, and that revolution was going to sort of spread around the world from Russia outward and eventually take down the American regime. But during World War II or after World War II, his mind started to change. He was never a Stalin apologist. So he was always suspicious of the Communist Party in Russia. But he wasn't really a believer in the American democratic experiment, or that he basically thought it had failed. But I don't know. At some point, he has a midlife crisis, and he becomes less serious about politics and less serious about all this other stuff. And he leaves his wife, and in the 50s, he actually just becomes a great, great magazine writer, and he sort of marks up a sort of series of institutions. Of some literary merit to take down. It starts with the great books set brought out by the University of Chicago and Encyclopedia Britannica, and it goes on to the new translation of the King James Bible. The revised version of the Bible, and finally he lands on Webster's Third, which he reads about in the newspapers. And as he examines the dictionary, he finds many things that he hates about it. And he writes the kind of classic takedown piece about Webster's Third called The String Untuned. And it goes through a lot of examples, some of which are kind of debatable about what's wrong with the dictionary. He does a very good job of reporting on the dictionary and describing how it was made, and he interviews Gove, and he's in fact a very accomplished journalist. His opinions about dictionary making are flawed. He doesn't know that much about dictionaries. What happens next is very interesting. At the end of his piece, he quotes a long speech from Troilus and Cressida by Shakespeare, and it's a speech describing kind of the end of the world, the oceans rising, governments crumbling, man turned against man, the sort of will to power. Sort of taking down all law or rule or reason, and basically civilization reduced to a state of nature. And this vision of an apocalypse is, strangely enough, inspired by Webster's Third.
Oh my goodness!
A dictionary, which does have its flaws. It's not a perfect piece of work, but it's a good, serious piece of work. And it's hard to take any dictionary as anything but some kind of act of homage to the language, far from trying to undermine the language, or let alone civilization and governments. It's a report. It's a respectful report on the language. Anyway, it was a very strange piece, but this kind of hysterical tone to it was not Dwight MacDonald's alone. You could find it in other writers, in Wilson Follett in The Atlantic, where he wrote about the dictionary and called it a sort of attack on civilization, and Jacques Barzun, the eminent historian who recently passed away, who's really a wonderful writer and a very, very distinguished historian. He too wrote about the dictionary as if it were some kind of roundabout attempt to bring down American and Western civilization.
My goodness!
So there was a lot of this craziness going around.
We're going to welcome our phone calls for our guest, David Skinner. His book is The Story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have quite a few emails that have come in as well. We'll get to some of those, I promise. We're going to put the H.L. Mencken rewriting of the Declaration of Independence on our Facebook page. Why don't we do that? Because I don't know how to work it in exactly. And it's really, it's if you've never seen it, a classic parody of vulgar American English, but actually I kind of like it. So we'll put that on our page after the show. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, where you can always leave messages for what we're talking about now or have talked about, or in some cases will talk about. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. More phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have an email, a follow-up on this, get married or married. Kelly emailed to say, yes, to marry, to divorce, etc., are freestanding verbs. They focus on the action itself. I married my husband in a church ceremony. To get married, divorced focuses on the result of the action. They got divorced a few years ago. Focus is on the subsequent state. There we go. Right, David?
I don't know about that. It sounds to me like get is a part of the verb in those sentences, and I'm not sure what's wrong with get as a sort of helping verb in that case. But I'd have to research it. I'm not sure what it's really considered. Often it can be very hard to figure out. I mean, I guess I don't disagree as a point of emphasis what those sentences are saying semantically, but it seems to me, in terms of the formal analysis of the parts of speech, I don't know that that really covers it.
Huh. Well, Kelly, what is your source, right?
All right. With all due respect to Kelly.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. Kelly, let us know where you received the information. Kay is next in Milwaukee. Hello, Kay.
Hi. Thanks for this excellent program. Just did reference before I say what I called in about to the person who talked about royalty with speech impediments. I think he may have been thinking Mary Berger, who wrote Speak Standard 2 for classroom teachers, has an account of a Spanish monarch, I think it was Frederick, who had a lisp. And as a result, Spanish has a pronunciation which reflects that lisp.
Castilian Spanish, right.
Yeah. What I really called about, though, the title of your book reminds me of a wonderful short paragraph in Shirley Bryce Heath's Ways with Words, Language, Life, and Work in Communities and Classrooms. And she looks at two communities, Tracton and Roadville, in Piedmont, Carolinas. And she says, both Tracton and Roadville children used ain't, and the teachers tried consistently to correct them. A teacher asked one day, where is Susan? Isn't she here today? Lem answered, she ain't ride bus. The teacher responded, she doesn't ride the bus, Lem. Lem answered, she do be riding the bus.
Mm-hmm.
The teacher frowned at Lem and turned away. Within the system of Black English, Lem used, ain't was used as equivalent to didn't.
Mm.
The negative of the past tense auxiliary do. Thus, his answer had to be interpreted as she didn't ride the bus. The teacher heard the ain't as equivalent to doesn't and corrected Lem accordingly. So I just thought that was...
That's a very funny passage.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, Kay, very much for the call. Okay, thanks for the call. Let's go to George in Glendale. Hi, George.
Yes, good morning. When you were talking about Downton Abbey and the beginning of the program, and we love it, we watch it all the time, I was thinking about the hypocrisy of the British upper class using language instead of merit to advance in the world. When you were born into nobility and you had this language, I think of George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, for example, to show that language does not replace merit. And I think there's this whole thing. I think of like that the second son in the noble family who could not inherit went into the Church of England or to Sandhurst. Military and the incompetence of the British military for the most part in World War One and to some degree in World War Two because it was based on nobility and not merit. So if you have any comments on that, please feel free. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
I guess I don't. In some ways, I don't have a comment, but I do. I am interested in the fact that we use language as a proxy for other things. And in a job interview, obviously, the interaction, or rather, the opinion of the person who's hiring the other, you know, is often determined, shaped a great deal by the other person's speech and how they present themselves, not only physically and visually, but but in the words they use and how they put things, and how they may put things that have nothing to do with the job. I happen to work with some people who are designers, who are so visually oriented and not are just less verbally oriented than the editors they work with. And so I'm often interested in noting the differences and how some people are often very good at explaining perhaps nothing. And others, with a lot to explain, struggle to put it all into words. And you might judge the latter very harshly because of the shortcomings of their ability to put everything into words, and it would be totally unfair. It would be kind of ridiculous in the way that you're saying the British upper class does. But I think it's an interesting. I mean, I think it's a very interesting thing, and I think it's sometimes discouraged by linguists that, you know, they say, you know, don't go around judging people on the basis of their usage. But we do it all the time. As much as we judge people on their appearance, we definitely judge them on the words they use and their pronunciation, mm-hmm. and basically how they put thoughts and information into words.
But you also, in the book, I'm thinking of Nora Zeal. What's her name again?
Zora Neale Hurston.
Zora Neale Hurston. You quote her and others who use a more vernacular speech, and yet the words of wisdom, the wisdom that comes from much of that is very important. Language may be important, but the wisdom is equally as important.
I think you're thinking of Sojourner Truth.
Right.
And the example of her "Ain't I a Woman" speech.
Mm-hmm.
I think definitely in American culture and American entertainment, we have these figures, these sort of less educated, simpler figures who are able to articulate wisdom and in their simplicity in a way that more educated people are not. In sitcoms all the time, and in television shows and in books, there's often a a simple character, maybe like Chauncey Gardner in the product example, who can speak truth, who are so unpretentious that they speak truths without any kind of anxiety or self-consciousness.
Yes.
And that it's liberating.
Yes.
I find that too when I'm home in New York and I'm hanging out with, you know, sort of more blue collar people I grew up with, and I don't mean this in a condescending way. There's a directness and a forcefulness to their speech that I can only imitate, and I find it very interesting and not in a condescending way. I think, you know, they're very clever, interesting, intelligent people, and they use the language in a way I don't, and I respect them for who they are, and because I've known them for a long time, and linguistically I find them kind of fascinating. There's a lot to be said for unpretentious speech.
Yes, Neil in Slinger. Hi.
Hi. I'll get to the point because we're running short on time.
Thank you, Neil.
I have a Walker's 1828 dictionary, which in the beginning has descriptions for enunciation or pronouncing by speakers from Ireland and Wales and blah, blah, blah. And, of course, within Walker's, they're utilizing this, and I'm curious as to the impact of these guides to pronouncing or enunciation of words, given the fact there was no media as we have today. How could they develop the correct sounds?
Oh, interesting!
And the
impact, yes,
of these early writers.
Great question.
Let's see. I don't entirely know the early history of how linguists were phonetically representing variation in speech before modern recordings. But recording equipment goes back to the 19th century. I know what they did at Merriam-Webster when they had a question is that they for Webster's Second, they sent around questionnaires to prominent speakers, I think they have on record how Woodrow Wilson pronounced economics and how that was different from how, Bernard Baruch pronounced economics. And so often they would rely on individuals to report their own pronunciation.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. David, thank you very much. It was a great hour. Thanks.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
David Skinner, the book is The Story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. I'm sorry, Neil, we didn't really get an answer to the question, and I know that you were talking about the 1828 dictionary, so we'll just have to find the answer on our own by going to, a dictionary. We'll put the H.L. Mencken rewrite of the Declaration of Independence on our Facebook page. It's amusing. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program. Thanks for all of your calls. Great conversations ahead.